haven't been familiar with the Bible, or you haven't maybe been a believer very long, Song of Solomon's in the Old Testament, almost right in the middle of your Bible. I'd like to just brief you on the format tonight because it's just a little bit different. We're going to have a Bible study that I hope I can terminate in 45 minutes. And after that, I'm going to baptize some people. You do not have to stay for the baptismal service. If you did not come for that or with that purpose in mind, you do not have to stay. You're very welcome to leave after the Bible study. There'll be Doug will be leading a couple songs up here while I'm getting ready for the baptismal service after we're done with the Bible service. We'd like to have everybody stay if you want to stay. Also, for those of you who are going to be baptized, as soon as the Bible study is over, and those that are going to assist them in the dressing rooms and so on, as soon as the Bible study is over, I want you to go right down to where you're going to change clothes, if you are going to change clothes and so on, and get ready for the baptism service. Okay? Now, for the benefit of those who were not here last week, we went over the general format of the Song of Solomon, and we defined or categorized what the book was about. We found that this is a love story. It's the story of human love, two members of the human race who fell in love with each other, and it's the story of the lasting qualities of that love. It's the kind of love that God, human love that God approves of, we found last week. Now, as we proceed through the first chapter tonight, we're going to get a little bit more of the background material to help us understand the book. You'll probably catch some of the spirit and the flow of the book. At least I hope you do tonight. We're going to look at chapter 1 in terms of exegesis, explain some of the verses to you, and try to glean just a few principles that we find relative to human love. Let's read verse 1, okay? I'll read and you listen. Now, I'm going to do some reading from the Amplified Old Testament because it follows the interpretation that we defended last week. It follows it quite closely. Verse 1 says, "The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's." Now, last week we saw that preposition in front of the word Solomon in Hebrew does not necessitate that Solomon wrote the book. It could mean that the book is simply about Solomon, and we know that it is about him. But it does not demand that he wrote the book. So it is a Song of Songs. When it says Song of Songs, it means a chief song, a main song of many songs that you'll find in the Old Testament. Now, this book is a book written in Hebrew poetic fashion. Now, even if it were in English poetic fashion, it leaves the interpretation up to one's subjectivity quite a bit. Hebrew is much worse in that category than English. The interpretation is very subjective. It's left very much up to the interpreter. And this is why if you missed last week's session, you should try to get a tape from one of our men to bring you up to date, because in it we defend the interpretation that we are about to follow. The villain in the book will be Solomon. The hero, or the heroine, will be a Shulamite woman, and her lover will be a simple shepherd from the area of Shulam in northern Palestine. All right, now chapter 1 and chapter 2, which is in the first scene of this drama, finds its setting in one of Solomon's apartments. He had apartments all over Palestine. And in this apartment, he had X number of wives and X number of concubines. In other words, he had haremsville wherever he went. And the book opens with a statement from one of the women from the harem. The Amplified reads this way, verse 2. "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And then it supplies the statement, she cries, then realizing that Solomon has arrived and has heard her speech, turning to him, she adds, for your love, literally the word is loves in Hebrew, your loves is better than wine. Now, she continues in verse 3. The odor of your ointments is fragrant. Your name is like perfume poured out. Therefore, King James says, do the virgins love you? Now that word for virgins in the King James, in verse 3, is not the technical verse 3 in King James. Yes. This word that's translated virgins is not the technical word that means virgins in the Old Testament. This is the word alma. Looks like this in Hebrew. This ayin is silent. This is the word alma. Now alma can be translated either young maidens or virgins. Now, in practically every other place that this word is translated in the Old Testament, it's translated virgin. And the context usually determines whether that's an accurate translation or not. The Amplified translates this maidens because it apparently does not refer to a virgin, since the one who is speaking is trying to make time with Solomon. She's trying to get into the bedroom with Solomon. She wants him to choose her. So she's speaking to Solomon and she says, I like your aftershave lotion. Your name connotates this fragrance to me. Therefore, do the maidens love you? Solomon apparently enters at this time into these apartments up in, probably about 50 miles north of Palestine. And as he enters, there's a chorus of voices that comes from his harem, from Haremsville. And they say, draw me, or select me. So he selects one, and the other ones are saying, we will run after you, we're going to pursue you. Whenever a woman falls into the category that Solomon's wives fell into, this is their approach to sex. They're going to be the chief aggressor in sex. And they, of course, want the favor of the kings, and so they are the one who makes the approach. Now, Amplified stops the sentence there, and the one that he has selected then speaks in this fashion. You notice the King James runs the sentences together, but the one who is chosen speaks this way, the king brings me, or hath brought me into his chamber. He has chosen me. Okay? So in verse 4, we have then a word, the word chambers. Now in this case, this word has to mean Solomon's bedroom suite. Okay? Solomon's bedroom suite. So what you have in the book, this is the word kader, or keder. Looks like this in Hebrew, keder. Keder. Keder can mean an apartment in general, or it can mean the innermost chamber of the apartment. In this case, it would be the bedroom. So Solomon has chosen out of Haremsville the one he wants to take to bed at this time, and so this one speaks and says, the king hath brought me. Now you notice that the Amplified has a very strong point here because the sentence before that has a plural subject. It says, we will run after you. And then the next statement is singular. The king hath brought me into his chamber. So the Amplified is interpreting this scene as a scene in apartments that Solomon has, not in the city of Jerusalem. There'll be a change of scene at the end of chapter 2 where he goes to the palace in Jerusalem. They interpret it, and I think rightly so, as a scene in Haremsville, somewhere in his apartments north of Jerusalem. After he selects this one that he desires, the rest of Hiram's bill speaks up in the latter part of verse 4, and they say, "We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will recall other occasions when we were favored with your love, which is more fragrant than wine. The upright are not offended by your choice, but we sincerely love you." Okay? So when the book begins, it opens sort of in medias res, in the middle of the drama. And Solomon has entered into his apartments north of Palestine, where a part of his harem, of course, is dwelling. Now, he maintains Haremsville in somewhat of a classic Arabian style. The place is fantastically sumptuous. And these queens and these concubines are dressed to kill. After all, they're living on the state, or living off the state. And introduced into that scene in verse 5 is a very common shepherd girl from northern Palestine. And she just appears on the scene. And she's very self-conscious about her appearance. And she speaks then in verse 5. She says, "I am black." Now that Hebrew word for black, that's exactly what it means. She was very dark. She was a Jewess. She had dark skin to begin with. Probably had black eyes, or at least dark brown, and black hair, with thick, bushy eyebrows and high cheekbones. And she was a fantastically beautiful girl. Elizabeth Taylor, Hilton, Wilding, Todd, Fisher, Burton didn't have anything on her. I should correct that. Elizabeth Taylor, Hilton, Wilding, Todd, Fisher, Burton, X. Who will make it number 6? What a track record. Had nothing on this girl. This girl is a raving Jewish beauty. But she's terribly sensitive about her appearance, because like anybody who lives in the land of sunshine, they're intelligent about the sun. They don't go in the sun. You ever see a southern farmer? He'll wear a shirt with the sleeves buttoned and the top button up here on his shirt. A West Texas farmer, that'll be buttoned, and he'll have a big hat on, because he knows how damaging the sun can be to his skin. They hide from the skin. But she had fallen into problems with her family, particularly her brothers, over her relationship with a man that she loved in the area of Shulam. She will not be named in the book. She will simply be called the Shulamite woman. Okay? Okay. Well, I should try to explain how she comes on the scene. We're not told in the book how she falls into this hapless lot, as far as she was concerned, of being one of many in Solomon's harem. But the story in the book is going to be the story how she resists Solomon's advances. Now, there are several things that apparently happened, and let's see in verses 5 and 6, and we'll combine that with chapter 6, a few verses, relative to the Shulamite woman. So these introduce the Shulamite woman. She is the heroine. Remember now, this is told in poetic fashion. Best way to interpret it is literally. She says, "I am black, but comely." Now the amplified there says that the refrain "you are comely" is a refrain that's stated by the Haremsville clan. I don't think that's true. I think the Shulamite woman says it. It's simply another adjective, predicate adjective. She says, "I am black," first. She says, "I'm sunburned," because I've been in the sun too much. But I'm comely, which means, she says, I still haven't lost my basic attractiveness. Which means that this gal, who was tremendously endowed by the Lord physically, had a good self-image about herself. She wasn't all hung up, you know, because she was a beautiful girl. If you happen to be endowed by the Lord, then you should be thankful. And you don't go around, you know, sort of stoop-shouldered and sort of, you know, try to hide your endowment if you're a woman. Be proud. Walk tall. Carry yourself erect. Not have this perverted image of yourself. Maybe you're not so endowed. That doesn't matter physically to God. The thing that matters is your image of yourself, and above all, how accurate it is from divine viewpoint. That's the important thing. And once a woman gets a good image of herself from God, then she begins to radiate a beauty that doesn't have anything to do with her physical capacity. This girl happened to be physically attractive, and she was not hung up about it. She says, I'm swarthy, I'm burned, I don't like it, but I'm comely. I'm easy to look at, and I'm aware of it. She speaks then to the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, we saw last week that the daughters of Jerusalem comprised three groups from the book. One, the queens. Two, the concubines. And three, those that are called the maidens or the virgins, who are sort of potential harem types. In other words, Solomon has a whole string of these on the line. And whenever he sees a beautiful girl, he tries to funnel into Haremsville. And the maidens, there is a group that becomes they become the attendants on the harem, on the queens and the concubines. So she's addressing this whole group, whatever ones are there in the apartment. And she says, I am black, but easy to look at, O you daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar. The Kedarites were Bedouin Arab tribesmen who had black, sort of ugly tents. She says, like the curtains or the tent cloth of Solomon. She was aware of the fact that the sun hadn't helped her. In verse 6, she tells us the circumstances that brought this on. Look not upon me, because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me, S-U-N, my mother's children, which were her brothers, were angry with me. This is Cinderella in reverse, see? Here it's her brothers who are angry. Here it's a girl that the king selects and tries to make part of his harem, and the story is that she resists him because she's in love with a simple shepherd from northern Palestine. So we have Cinderella in reverse. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard have I not kept. So what she's saying is, one, her brothers, this is part of the background now, her brothers had, apparently her father is dead. Her brothers had removed her from Shulam. Her brothers had removed her from Shulam. Now apparently, they were fearful for her relationship with this shepherd. They wanted to protect her. But they didn't understand how deep that relationship was. And they were trying to break up a love relationship. And they were wrong in the matter. But they had removed her from Shulam. And secondly, the way that they did it was they made her tend vineyards. They made her tend vineyards. Okay? Which meant that she was fully exposed to the sun. And this had burnt her, and her complexion was such that she didn't like it, which means that she was very much a woman. She was very concerned about how she looked. She wanted to look attractive. She wanted to look pleasing, particularly to her shepherd lover. That was the one that she was really interested in. And I'll tell you, I've noticed with teenagers, if they're sloppy for a while, one thing that'll correct that sloppiness is when one member of the opposite sex shows a little bit of interest in them. So if you have a teenager that's kind of sloppy now, well, you just anticipate the day when some member of the opposite sex comes along and shows a little interest in them. They're going to perk up. They're going to try to look a little sharper. And that's a good thing. They're going to try to be attractive and not so sloppy. So this girl was very much concerned about her own appearance. Now, apparently, while she was off in these vineyards, she became lured into an entourage of Solomon that was in the northern part of Palestine. Now, will you look at the 8th chapter? And this will help us somewhat get the movement of the book, the story. Okay? Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. Now, Unger says we do not know where Baal Haman was. At least, Unger says he doesn't know, which means that he's looked in all the dictionaries and so on. And in his dictionary, he says we don't know where it is. There are some other Hebrew commentators that said it was very possibly a place about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. Well, it isn't overly important precisely where it is. The thing that's important is that Solomon had a vineyard there, see? And he probably had some apartments very close or very near to that area. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Everyone for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. These were very productive vineyards, and hence he leased them for 1,000 pieces of silver for those who would run the vineyards. Now, apparently, the vineyard that she was tending was somewhere near to those vineyards that Solomon had. So, will you look at chapter 6? Chapter 6 and verse 11. Where there is a flashback, and she is making reference to her personal experience, apparently before chapter 1 happened. Well, let's go back and get some idea of what she, of the impression that she made on the harem. And it's right in the same paragraph, so it'll save us looking at it again. Verse 8 says, there were 80 queens at 60, 40 concubines at 80, and virgins without number. Now those, Solomon is speaking, and he says, my dove, my undefiled ones, or my undefiled is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She was the only daughter in the family. She is the choice one of her that bear her. When the daughters, meaning the daughters of Jerusalem, Haremsville, saw her, they blessed her and said, yea, the queens and the concubines, they praised her. And they said, who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible, a certain flash and flare about her eyes, particularly when she was angry, terrible as an army with banners. Now that was the harem's impression of the Shulamite woman. In verse 11 of chapter 6, the Shulamite woman speaks, and I'd like to read this to you from the Amplified. I'm sorry if I confuse you. Sometimes I read from the King James. Most people carry a King James Bible. Verse 11, the Shulamite woman speaks and says, I went down to the nut orchard one day to look at the green plants of the valley, to see whether the grapevine had budded and the pomegranates were in flower. Now listen to verse 12 from the Amplified. Before I was aware of what was happening, my desire to roam about had brought me into the area, now listen to this, of the princes of my people. It brought me into the king's retinue, or what we would call the courtiers of the king. Okay? Now, how did they get that translation? The King James translates, or ever I was aware, my soul may be like the chariots of Amminadab. I'd like to try to show that to you. The picture really here in verse 12, chapter 6, verse 11 and 12, is that the Shulamite woman roams. She roams into Solomon's retinue. Now, perhaps he had seen her before. We don't know. And maybe he had selected her and told his men to try to lure her into Haremsville. We don't know. But here she comes into contact with men of his chariots, with people of his retinue. And she's somewhat bewildered. Okay, if I were to translate this, I'd translate verse 12 this way. Before I was aware, before I became conscious of what happened, my soul put me in the area or into contact with. There's two ways you can translate this. You can translate it like the King James, into contact with, one possible translation, the princes of my people. Which, of course, would be part of Solomon's court. The second possible translation would be with the people, or, no, that's the same as that, with the prince of the realm. Okay. In other words, the word Amminadab is two Hebrew words. If you translate it as two words, then you would make it the people, the noble ones. That's how the Amplified chooses to translate it. If you make it one word, then you would say she ran into the prince of my people, or the prince of the realm, instead of the princes of the realm. See? Depends totally whether you take the Hebrew word as one or two words, and that's what Amminadab means. The King James translators simply elect to transliterate the word and put a capital letter on it, Amminadab, and it doesn't make sense. Okay? So, apparently what happens then in verse 13, she seeks to escape, or she seeks to run. She's sort of in panic. And so the Amplified translates this way. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return that we may look upon you. And then I replied, what is there for you to see in the poor Shulamite? And they answered, it is like a dance before two armies, or a dance of Mahanaim, like an angelic beauty, like a heavenly dance to look at you. Now, it may be at this very point, we don't know, that this is the place where the Shulamite woman then is brought into contact with Solomon and taken to his apartments in the northern part of Palestine. Okay? Okay. All of that is by way of background. Her brothers and her family will be mentioned again in chapter 8, but only at the climax of the story. Okay, let's go back to chapter 1. So here she is now in the court. We can put a question here by verse 12, or taken to Solomon's apartments. Here she is showing up, and she's expressing her disdain for the fact of her appearance. She doesn't like it. She's concerned about it. She wants to look nicer. Okay? Okay. Apparently, she's very stunningly beautiful, if you notice the reaction in chapter 6 of the harem. Now, actually, this girl is in a crisis situation, and she becomes very much aware of it in chapter 1. Let's go on with verse 7. In verse 7, she is thinking about the person that she loves. This simple shepherd from the northern reaches of Palestine. Well, really up by Mount Gilboa, by the end of the Valley of Jezreel. And she's thinking about him. Solomon is not present at this time. He's going not to appear on the scene again until verse 9. So she says in verse 7 of chapter 1, and I'm reading from Amplified now. Addressing her distant shepherd, she says, "Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, tell me where you pasture your flock." So she is not addressing a king now, but she is addressing a shepherd. Got it? "Tell me where you are. Tell me where you lie down at noon, where you take your rest for the day. For why should I think of you? Why should I, as I think of you, be as a veiled one, straying beside the flocks of your companions?" So she's very concerned about this man who she loves in her soul. The word for soul in verse 8 is the word nephesh. It's the normal word for soul in the Old Testament. Soul is nephesh. Now, your soul is your animation. Now, your soul is what gives animation to your life, gives bent to your life, gives meaning to your life. Her soul, like our soul, was comprised of certain facets, certain capacities. Every person, every member of the human race is comprised of a mind, and part of that mind is his soul. If he's born again, if he's a believer, then his spirit has become alive to God, and he is mind with soul and spirit as two banks of his mind. There is another resource that he has that is called his heart in Scripture. Another resource of his mind. His heart in Scripture is the deepest resource of his mind, soul, and spirit. His heart in Scripture is that which makes up his frame of reference. Now, this girl has said that my soul loves this shepherd from the north, which meant that in her self-consciousness, and in her mentality, and in her volition, and her emotions, and in her senses, in her conscience, she was very deeply identified with this young man. For instance, in her self-consciousness, when she looked in, your self-consciousness is that thing that when you look in the mirror, you say, "That's me." When you look in the mirror, you don't say, "That's somebody else." When you look at a picture with a group of people on it, you say, "Hey, that's me on the picture." In fact, that's the first one you look at. Is that right or not? I looked at some pictures of me this week, and I didn't believe that was me. I never saw such a haggard, tired-looking old man as on those pictures. Terrible. Wasn't even me. Somebody else was there that night. In your self-consciousness is your self-image, who you think you are. Your self-image may be an accurate representation of who you are, may not be. In her self-consciousness, when she looked in the mirror, she said, "I wonder if he likes my hair this way. I wonder if I should put eyeshadow on or not put eyeshadow on. I wonder if he likes that." Everything she did relative to herself, she related to her shepherd lover because she loved him with her soul. In her mentality, which includes her IQ and her intelligence, among other things, there's never a word for mind. There's never a word for brain in Scripture. There's only a word for mind. It connotates the idea of mentality. In her mentality, she was occupied with her shepherd lover. In this book, she is in the most sumptuous apartment that was ever built in Old Testament times. All the goblets and drinking utensils are either solid silver or solid gold. Solomon had stables that were unparalleled in the ancient world. It was a real plush place, you know. Flushing Meadows, New York, Hialeah type place. Hialeah, well, yeah, the track is okay. What is that, 32nd Street in Florida? 30, I forget. It's Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. It's Cherry Hill, you know. And despite the advances of Solomon and the allurements and the attraction of all these physical things that he has, she doesn't give a hoot about them. All she's thinking about is that little old house with rough-hewn cedar beams that her shepherd lover is making for her, and he makes reference to it. She makes reference to it in the last part of the chapter. She says, "Behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant. Also, our bed is green," meaning that their bed was unused, but he was getting it ready. She said in verse 17, "The beams of our house are cedar, and the rafters of fir, rough hewn." While Solomon has her in the sumptuous palace, she's thinking about how nice it would be to be back in the little old one-room log cabin that the guy that she loved was making. That's the way her mentality is running. In her volition, she's making decisions relative to him. She has her own mind with positive and negative poles, but he is included in these decisions, what she's going to do. In her emotions and senses, which are the appreciators of her soul, she really appreciates this guy. She likes his eyes. She likes the way he handles himself as a man. She likes the stability she sees in him, the manliness she sees in him. And her emotions and her senses find a certain stabilizing element in that, because the man is the stabilizer of the woman. Is Betty Friedan here? Sorry about that, Betty, that just happens to be the way God made it. When God, after the fall, when he addressed the woman, he said, "Your desire will be to the man." And go ahead and try to slough that off. You do it to your own aggrandizement, your own jeopardy if you're a woman. You have an innate desire in your nature to identify with the man so that he is the stabilizer of the woman in a healthy relationship. If the woman is the stabilizer of the man, then you have an unhealthy relationship. The shoe is on the wrong foot. He is a stabilizer of this woman. And in her emotions and her senses, she is responding to him. In her conscience, she loves this man, but she does not reject the norms and standards of divine viewpoint. Hence, she is a heroine in the Bible. She incorporates her love for him and her expressions of her love for him. She incorporates those into those principles of divine viewpoint that she knows God will bless in the human relationship. And hence she has a beautiful love relationship. So she says in verse 5, "My nephesh loves this man." Well, that's what the book is about. Will you turn to chapter 8, because it's time for me to close already. Can't believe it. In chapter 8, in verses 5 through 8, you have the climax of the book. You have the end of the book, the actual climax. She has rejected persistently all of Solomon's advances in a very alluring and a very seductive environment. He had all the X-rated movies. He had his concubine showing X-rated movies, etc. She wasn't even concerned with him. And he finally has to let her go. And in verse 5, she is coming back to Shulam with her shepherd lover. And you read this statement. "Who is he that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Who is this that cometh up?" I should read this from the Amplified. "Who is this that comes up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved?" They're together now. Amplified adds as an explanatory sentence, "And as they sighted the home of her childhood, the shepherd lover said, Under the apple tree I awakened you. The King James says, I raised thee up under the apple tree. It was under the apple tree that these two had pledged their love to each other. Their love was awakened to each other, and they became engaged. They became betrothed. So he says, under the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother gave you birth. She's back in the land of her nativity. There she was in travail who bore you. Now listen to this dramatic statement in verse 6. Set me as a seal upon your heart. Meaning, place me as something dear, something precious upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is as hard and cruel as Sheol, the abode of the dead. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a most vehement fire, a flame of Yahweh. The flashes there are the flashes of love. They are strong, they are powerful. And this is the book that tells us the story of true human love and its strength and the character that it can lend the person. Verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. And here is the climax of the book, the thing that the author is trying to get across. If a man, if any man would offer all of the goods of his house for love, he would be utterly scorned and despised, because you cannot purchase this kind of love with material things. That's the message of this book. It is the story of true human love and the strength that it brings to two individual members of the human race. As we move through the book, we'll be taking up principles of human love, so that next week we'll begin right where we left off in chapter 1, where the Shulamite woman is speaking about her shepherd lover. I wanted to finish chapter 1 tonight and give you at least three principles of human love from the chapter, so I kind of feel like I'm, we drive right off the end of the cliff and that's the end of the story. So I hope you'll forgive that. I hope you'll be back next week to pick up where we left off. I think the principles of the book are very, very important for all of us. I'm so very happy to see so many of you here with your families, particularly teenagers and mothers and dads. I hope that you'll find this very profitable. I would like for those who are going to be baptized, if you'll get up at this time and leave. And those of you who would not care to stay for the service, you may leave at this time, and Doug's going to come and lead us in some songs while we get ready. Thank you.